Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Ewan DeLeo, a seasoned HR maestro with over 15 years of expertise in shaping global multinational corporations. Beginning as an entrepreneur, Ewan transitioned into a design thinking HR generalist, mastering roles from talent acquisition to HR transformation. Currently, as the executive vice president of people operations at Toll Group, he crafts strategies enhancing employee experiences in 26 countries directly, plus a network spanning 150 countries. Passionate about the interplay of language and culture in business, Ewan is driven by integrity, impact, and innovation. His journey reflects a commitment to fostering organizational cultures that catalyze growth at every level. I've asked Ewan to join us here today to share his story and explore the intricacies of human capital challenges. So Ewan, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. How are you?
I'm great, and thank you for having me. I have to say, Daryl, that introduction, I need to copyright it because I love it.
Aw, thanks.
The best anybody has ever described me. I love it, yeah.
Pat on the back there. Pat on the back. Good job, Daryl. All right, interview over. All right, bye, everyone. So before we get into the intricacies of what you're doing, how did you even get into this? Obviously, this is an integral part of any business, managing and developing and nurturing people. You come from a family of either entrepreneurs or people that worked in HR. Is this something?
Nope, not at all. No.
You didn't sit around the dinner table discussing team building strategies?
And even once I got here, when I tried to do that at home, nobody quite understood what I was talking about. No, it's one of those things. I tell people often, you know what? I didn't plan anything, but I couldn't have planned it any better. And quite frankly, a lot of the people back home, when I talk to people back home, I grew up in a really little small town in the Netherlands. When I tell them these days, because now we're reconnecting through social media and everything, right, and tell people these days what I do, most people, they start laughing. That's the typically their first reaction, as like, I can't believe that you ended up in human resources, because my father actually was a veterinarian. His brothers were doctors. My mother's family, there were a lot of doctors there. A lot of like scholars, so nothing to do with corporate life, quite frankly. I think I was a little bit the black sheep of the family, but I ended up well, so like it's okay.
Right. Got it. So how did you even get started into this role? Did you know this is what you wanted to do, or did you fall into it, or?
No, it's a lot, like I said, actually my career path was a little bit different, and I'm going to say untraditional. After secondary school, I was actually a little bit of a late to a certain extent. I still am a little bit of a late bloomer. So when I was in secondary school, I was thinking about what to do. I thought I was going to do something with linguistics or language. But towards the end of secondary school, I had all of this, I thought, an epiphany, and I wanted to join the military. I wanted to become an officer in the army. I did. I actually ended up in the army for 5 years as an officer.
Oh, wow.
But towards the end, I had a stint for, what is it, supposed to do about 8 years. But while I was in the army, I was actually stationed in Germany when the wall fell. That sort of betrays a little bit.
Right.
Gives a little bit of my way how old I am.
Yeah.
But at that time, I realized, so is this actually what I wanted to do? And for some reason, early on in my life, I thought in cycles of 5 years. I don't know where that came from, but I always thought like every 5 years I need to do something new, something exciting, whatever. I have no idea where it came from, but I hit that cycle at that point in time, and I thought, do I really want to continue as a military man? I enjoyed my military life, but something was missing. So I actually decided to go back to school, much to the dismay of my parents, because when I told them I was going to go to the military, they were utterly disappointed. And by the time they got used to the fact, like, you know what, he's pretty successful in his military career, this is a good thing, I told my parents, you know what, I've decided against it.
Like, no, government money is good. Yeah.
So it was, I remember that conversation very vividly when I told my parents, listen, I'm going to go back to school. You don't have to support me. And they were very distraught. But again, I went back to school. So I actually studied Japanese and international management. I got a master's degree in that eventually. Yeah, I like to do things a little bit the hard way. And at the end of that, I was actually thinking about pursuing, originally I thought I'm going to combine this language and this education and my military career. Maybe it can be like a military attaché. I wanted to join the diplomatic service, but I actually did an internship while I was still studying, and I got a lot of interaction with the embassy, and I realized that is actually probably not what I want. That environment is not what I'm looking for. So I parked that idea. Then I started looking for jobs. I got some really interesting offers from financial institutions for some reasons. I had no financial background, but they seemed to be liking my profile. So I was talking to companies like ABN AMRO, ING, like big Dutch financial institutions. But at some point it hit me, and I've been studying Japanese. Why don't I go to Japan?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't advise anybody to do what I did next, because I just decided to leave the Netherlands. I basically sold everything that I had. I was actually in a relationship with a girl, but I also ended that. I moved to Japan with one suitcase without a job.
Yeah.
And then while I was in Japan, and again, I really strongly believe in things happen for a reason. I was offered a job with a headhunting firm.
Okay.
I had no experience in that field whatsoever. I frankly had no corporate experience at all.
Where did you go in Japan? I'm just curious. I lived in Tokyo for 3 years.
When I moved to Japan, I also went to Tokyo, but while I was studying, sorry?
Which part? Where?
I remember I told you about the suitcase, right? So yeah. I literally moved around everywhere. I was everywhere. I was in Ningyocho, I was in Azabu-Juban, I was out on the outskirts. I was literally everywhere. I think I lived there, the time that I lived in Tokyo, I was about 3.5 years. I think I lived in 9 places, because in the beginning, you can't really afford an apartment.
Yeah. So and you don't know where things are. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. I lived, I think, on every major train line in Japan. And it was fantastic. It was a different time. I was young. I was living other with people. You get to meet some crazy people when you live with other people. It was great. But I had the good fortune, because I'd been studying Japanese, I also lived for about 9 months on 2 occasions. I did 2 internships. One time in Saitama, which is...
Yeah, Saitama.
But my first ever experience in Japan was in Kyushu, because I lived in Oita, which is very close to the famous onsen areas over there, the hot springs that they have. So I basically grew up on the countryside of Japan, which was very nice.
Have to learn Japanese there. Nobody speaks English there. And there's not, like in Tokyo, for people that don't know, a lot of restaurants, it was such a godsend. A lot of them have wax plastic food outside. Like the menu is in a glass case, and you can see like a wax model, almost like it, like wax statues of what your meal will look like. So you can like, oh, that.
Points,
you can
point. Yeah.
When you're in the country, you just have a menu of just like gibberish, and you have no idea what you're ordering. It's just pure luck of the draw.
I mean, it actually was such a stark difference, because in Tokyo, although I got there in the 90s, late 90s, so you were quite anonymous, I think, as a foreigner. But to your point, my first experience in Japan, I also happened to work at a bank. I did an internship at a bank.
Oh, me too.
But every day when I would go back, I would go to work, people at work could tell me where I'd been, with whom, what I'd been doing, because I literally was basically the only foreigner probably in a 50 or 80 kilometer radius, right? So it was very humbling.
It's an interesting experience. Yeah, I worked at Shinsei Bank too. That's very interesting.
I used to be a customer at Shinsei Bank.
What? Yeah, I used to work at their headquarters. I forget the station name, but it was a beautiful station. And they had one of those earthquake-proof buildings, and I used to be in the top boardroom at the very top. And I remember once in a meeting, like there was an earthquake, and I just thought the building was going to fall, because it slides. It's like on tracks and it slides, and the building's designed to wave. And I'm like grabbing on to stuff, like, my good, what is happening? And they're like, no, it's okay. It's supposed to do. I'm like, a building is not supposed to shake. Like, I had no idea that they designed buildings this way. I'm like, the building is moving. We are falling, people.
That's another thing. I mean, you get used to that really quickly, because again, to your point, in most other cities, there's not a ton of high rise, but in Tokyo, of course, there is. Right. Every office, to your point, under every desk, there's water bottles, there's a safety kit, although the buildings move. So it's It's like super, super safe. It's amazing. Yeah.
I remember the first one, I got annoyed. I was in a cubicle and I thought someone was jumping like beside me and I was trying to talk to a student and they were like jumping. And I'm like, who is jumping? I stand up and look, and there was nobody there but us. It was like a Sunday or something. I realized, oh, that's an earthquake. So Japan is a trip. Japan is definitely a trip. Yeah, a lot of fun.
Listen, right. So I still have a crush on Japan, and this is what I tell everybody when they ask me like places to go, places to visit, because I've been around. Yeah. I tell, listen, you in your lifetime you need to go to Japan. If there's one location, just go there for the food.
Kyoto. I always tell people you got to go to Japan and then Kyoto. Just drink the coffee, take the caffeine, and just acknowledge I'm going to have 20,000, 30,000 step days, and just go to every, because they're all unique, all the different temples. Just go to them all. Go to them all. Just go to them all. It is just such a life enriching experience. Yeah. What a unique place. Oh, so what? So you went to Japan, you got connected with a headhunting company.
Yeah. So I got connected with a headhunt company. I worked there for about three years. I actually met my wife while I was living there. My wife was on an expat assignment. She's Vietnamese American.
Oh, wow.
And I promised her, apparently the first night we ever went out, this was probably the alcohol for talking. this is what I tell people, right? But apparently even on the first night out, I made a promise as in, listen, if you go back, I'll go with you. It was that sort of military code. And she cast that chip like about, I don't know, 10, 12 months later. She said, oh, I'm being repatriated back to the US. You want to come? And I was like, I guess if I gave you my word, let's do this. So I did the same thing I did 3.5 years before. I packed up all my stuff, said goodbye to my job, moved to the US. And originally I thought I was going to continue in recruiting because I really enjoyed that job. It's, you know, sales, it's edgy. If you love movies like, and again, this shows my age a little bit, but movies like Glengarry, Glenn Ross, that kind of mentality. Yeah, exactly.
You're gonna have brass balls to survive in this line of work.
That's put the coffee down. But anyway, so when I went to the US, and I thought, you know what, US, this is probably the mecca of recruiting. This is going to be really good. But quite frankly, I'd been brought up in a particular company with a particular culture where I got to do everything. So I tried to find that again, and I couldn't find it. So this is actually one of my earlier lessons. But once you get like certain cultures you like, it's very difficult to replicate and find that again. So when people jump ship, you need to think of that, because some people just think about the money, but you're leaving behind some other things. Anyway, so I moved to the US. I actually worked very briefly for another recruiting company, but I just wasn't happy. And then again, luck came my way, and I got like a call for an RPO firm, this outsourced recruiting firm. And they said that the GE, General Electric, is looking for somebody. And would you be interested? And I wasn't quite interested in the RPO side of things, but I'm like, this is going to get my foot in the door with General Electric. I'm in. So I went there, and that's where my career really took a massive turn and took off, because I got in a position, I maneuvered myself in a position a little bit to show people at General Electric, you're getting this service from an RPO, but I'm actually a real recruiter. Sorry for all the RPO people that are listening. But I worked on commission like hard. I said, and I told the people, gee, let me show you what I can do, but unshackle me, because if you just want me to work 40 hours a week, I can't make a dent in what you want. But if you start paying me the overtime and all the other stuff, I'll work 80 hours a week. I don't care. I'll fill all your jobs, which I did. And then they started to take notice. And then I got, at some point, I started talking with my GE boss, and I said, I love this company. I would really love to work for you as a GE employee, because the first half year or something, or maybe 12 months, I worked technically for the RPO. And they said, we'd love to have you. And they actually offered me a job back in Tokyo. They said, how about we make you the HR manager in Tokyo? And I was like, I'd love to, but there's no way I can convince my wife to go right back. That's just not going to work. So I missed that opportunity. But again, that was another life lesson, because sometimes you think, oh, this is the opportunity that missed. But actually, one door closes and another opens. And that happened for me as well. So I joined GE's HR leadership program, which in the US was a program for people with like advanced degrees, maybe a little bit of work experience that were like pegged as, okay, this is the new future for HR at GE. And I joined the capital division within GE, and the rest is basically history. So I worked for GE for 13 years. Ultimately, so I had different jobs in rapid succession in the US. I was basically based in Chicago all that time. I had jobs in Florida, in Wisconsin, Salt Lake City.
Right.
So I was all across the US. And I actually had jobs outside where I was managing things outside of the US, so even Latin America and other parts of the world. And then in 2015, and this actually had to do with, I was looking to go either back to Europe, where I'm from, because there were lots of opportunities in General Electric, or to Asia, because my parents were living in Asia. And I tried, but this is the dual career thing. It's sometimes very difficult. So we couldn't quite make it. Every time I had an opportunity, my wife couldn't find another opportunity, or she had something, it didn't work for me. But at some point, in 2014, stars aligned. And my wife was offered a job here in Singapore. Mm. And so she came and asked me and said, what do we should we do? I said, you know what, honey, just take it. And like, at that point in time, I'd been with GE close to 10 years. And I said, listen, if I can't find a job with GE, I'll find another job. Don't worry. Right. Now I have a pedigree. We're going to be fine. Let's just go. So we did. So we arrived here in 2015. I worked for GE for another like 3 years. And then I left GE. And then subsequently, I worked in Vietnam for a year.
Hanoi.
Yeah, I've been there. That was great. I wouldn't say it was pioneering work, but it was very humbling because for 13 years, I'd worked in like an institution like GE, where HR, the position of HR is very different in General Electric than many other companies. And a lot of things as an HR practitioner, there's a huge support network that you don't even realize how good you have it. But when I went to Vietnam, where I was tasked to completely restructure a bank and the HR organization, then I realized, oh my God, I basically have to do everything myself, which was really great. So I really had to roll up my sleeves and, okay, how do we build this? And I had the knowledge, of course, what good looks like, but you need to build something that is fit for purpose for a different organization, which was a fun run.
And Hanoi is beautiful. How was it with the cultures? Because obviously you're going from Japanese. I mean, obviously you're from Europe, then you're in Japan. Now you're in America. Now you're in Singapore. Now you're in Vietnam. I lived 2.5 years in Vietnam, Hanoi, Saigon, and Da Nang. And like culturally, I remember when I first went to Japan, like I was like, we're all people. We all have hearts and hair and skin. We're all one. And then after living in Japan, and especially coming back from Japan, I realized there are real cultural differences. Doesn't mean we can't get along. We can get along, but there are real cultural differences. So I'm just curious if you could speak to that a little bit. Maybe, I don't know if things were easy. Yeah.
Yes, like, I think the fun part is, I think probably people will probably say, oh, it must have been tough in Japan and tough in Vietnam. But I'm actually going to say where I had the toughest time was actually when I moved to the US. And I'd been living in Japan. When I lived in Japan, I'm not Japanese, but I understood culture. And if you're walking around, you just see all the Japanese people. You sometimes forget that you're not Japanese. I was always very well aware that I wasn't Japanese.
Right.
But it's just,
and they won't let you forget. But you,
That's right. Right. Trust me. Sometimes they make you remember you're not one of us. Yeah. But it's okay because you realize, okay, this is Japan. It's different. Yeah. It's okay.
But in Rome.
But when I moved to the US, and again, you have this idea, oh, this is Western culture, blah, blah, blah. So I went to the US, and I think the first year, Daryl, I had serious problems adjusting to the US.
Right.
And not because it's so very different, but it's because in many cases, in many ways, I should say, I lived in Chicago. And to me, it feels very European, Chicago. But how people do things and how people talk and did it. I made the mistake. I never did this while I lived in Japan, but I made this mistake when I moved to the US. And again, it was a great lesson. I constantly compared the US to Europe. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work because then you go, oh my God, this is better or this is worse. Or why are they doing this? And you can't wrap your head around it. The moment I said to myself, stop doing this, just, it is what it is. This is the US. Just go with the flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was in such a much better place. And I took that lesson. Again, to me, it's more natural to do it. Okay, if you go to Vietnam, of course, I'm going to be different. So I need to do that again. But any other country that I live in, I realize I need to do it. Even here in Singapore, let go of what you know, right? Just try to figure out how people do it here and give it your own flair, because you're still who you are. And I think there's value in bringing that to the table for other people as well. But
can you give some tips? Like, how do you figure out if someone's starting out or struggling? When you're talking, I'm thinking of a client that is literally trying to expand from Europe. They've got 40, 50 locations across Europe, and they're struggling to get established in the United States. So that's one. And then also, I know for myself, when I'm in the Philippines now, when I left North America and came to the Philippines, I came here brazenly thinking that, oh, I'll be able to just apply what I know that's been very successful in North America here. And it was like a brutal wake-up call. And you don't expect it. So do you have any recommendations for someone starting out and struggling? Like, specific, how do you find those things out? How do you get through that?
Wow, that's a really good question. I actually am not sure how to answer that. I think for me, because of my background, because of my studies, I've always been, again, this sounds a little bit pretentious, I think, but I think I've been culturally aware. And I think the first thing that you need to do is get to that level. What are the different? It starts with very rudimentary things. And there's actually some really great tools out there that you can compare. Hey, my culture versus that culture. Yep. I want to make decisions. It's a little bit, because some of these things, they are, to your point, they're unspoken. So yes. You go in and nobody will directly to your face, in most cases, tell you, hey, Iwan, or hey, Daryl, that's not how we do things. You learn the hard way. Right. Yep. So again, there's a couple of tools, things like the one that comes to mind is Globe Smart, where they literally compare, okay, this is a person from this country, typically, this is a person from this country. So you can see this is how people make decisions, or this is how they think. Of course, it's a little bit theoretical, but I think it's a really good start.
Yeah.
And again, I think in business, you have this vernacular that says, what is it? Think global, act local. And I think this act local thing is what people typically forget, because they've done things and it works everywhere else, but that doesn't mean it works in this particular constituency. Yeah, you need to be very careful. Yeah. But a golden tip?
Yeah, fair enough. Because I like, just for people that maybe aren't aware, because you don't understand the lens that, like, everybody is wearing a cultural lens, and it's like wearing a pair of sunglasses that are tinted orange. And you've only ever seen the world with orange, this orange tint, because you've grown up in a country. And that's all you really know. And then when you go to another country, and even then it takes time. I had to live in Japan for a year and a half before I realized how often and frequently I offended people. And it wasn't because I was being trying to be rude or anything. That's why I see you laughing. Like, I was just being friendly Canadian Daryl, and I had no idea. I remember, anyways, I won't go down a tangent because we're limited time, but there were things where, I'll tell a simple story, simple example. I remember I went to the international grocer to get some mango chutney. We're having Indian night at home, cooking food. We wanted some mango chutney. I go to this international grocer where we usually buy it, and they don't have any on the shelf. So I go to the lady at the counter and I'm like, mango chutney, arimasuka? Do you have mango chutney? And the girl, she's like, oh, sumimasen, ima wa chotto. Like, excuse me, right now is a little. And I'm like, right now is a little what? Like, you got it? You're going to go check in the bag? Do I come back next week? What's going on? And she's like sweating and the lineup is building. I'm like, what do I do? Do you have some or no? And she was just like looking around. Then she like covered her mouth and she goes, nai. And then like covered her mouth again. And it's because I forced her to be so direct with me when I should have said, you know what? I've got somewhere else to go. I think I know. When she said, excuse me, right now is a little, I was supposed to jump in and let her save face. And that is a small example. Another example people may know, like in Japan, black suit, right? Business card. When someone gives you their business card, you need to admire it. You need to like look at it, you put it on the table.
Flip it over.
You need to examine their business card. Wow, nice business card. Whoa, okay, good font. Put it on the table. And I don't know, you might be able to tell me this is true or not, but as another example, someone told me, if you're going to do business in Singapore, it's business casual, but it has to be a collared shirt and a name brand. And if it's not a name brand, they won't take you seriously. You'll show up and it'll be smiles and handshakes in the room, but when you leave, you won't get the deal signed. And it's probably because you showed up a little too not fitting in. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he said. I was like, any tips if I go do business in Singapore? And he's like, wear business casual, like khakis and dress shirt is fine, but it's got to be a name brand. If it's not a name brand, they just won't take you seriously. And it'll be,
Yeah, personally, I've never heard that, but this description that doesn't surprise me because people want to be buttoned up here. In that sense, it's a little bit more, it's not conservative at all, but a little bit more conservative, if you know what I mean. So this description doesn't surprise me, but I hadn't heard it before. But yeah, you're right. This
But as an
cultural
example of
awareness.
cultural differences, where in Japan you have to wear the suit. If you're wearing pants and a collared shirt, then who is this slat? Like, who is this person? If you're going to
Slacker.
come talk to me, you got to be dressed appropriately.
Yeah, in that sense, to your point, I remember. So I worked in Japan, suit and tie all day
That's it.
long, no
That's it.
excuses. Then I went to the US, and then I could lose the tie. That was great, but it was losing the tie. And then ever since, like now I'm here in Singapore, and to your point, it's even more casual. I see him wearing like polos, and that's all totally fine. It's dress for the day kind of stuff, which is, I'm loving it, but I'm like, wow, I wish that would have been the case 25 years ago. But no, but I think to their point about this cultural thing, I think you can actually use it both ways because, on the one hand, is this sort of trying to be as culturally aware. And actually, the best way to go is I don't know a thing, and then let the other person guide you. I think that's typically worked for me very well. And being extremely polite, you'll never go wrong. Just don't assume a thing. That's one. The flip side of this, though, is you have a little bit of an advantage if you're a foreigner because, and I'm going to say this in a little bit in Japanese to your point, but when I lived in Japan, and many people that have lived in Japan that are not Japanese probably recognize this, I knew you need to fit in and be nice and don't put people in the wrong spot. But on occasion, you can play what I would call, and many other people probably would call, the gaijin card, as
That's right, the
i.e. the
Gaijin card.
foreigner
That's
card. Like
right.
at some points, you can actually use it because you can fake ignorance and be a little bit more bull to get what you want, but
That's
you
right.
need to use it very sparingly. And I've done this, and not just in Japan, but even in my time in Vietnam. Again, I wanted to fit in. I was doing certain things. I was on a board, so I had a huge office and there. But I also played this card because occasionally I would literally sit in the open area with everybody, and then people would ask, "What's the big guy doing here?" And it actually confused people. But I was actually trying to see, listen, yes, we have this, and yes, this is the local culture, but that doesn't mean you sometimes can do different things because, to your point, we're just also normal human beings. Like, why do I need to have an office that is, I don't know, 20 square meters? I can also sit and work in a cubicle. I don't really need this. But you need to do it very, very deliberately and not too often because otherwise it loses its value. But you can do that to sometimes prove a point without being in people's faces. That's why you need to be very delicate when you do it, right?
Yeah, you gotta keep your powder dry. You gotta save that crap
Correct.
for when you really
Yeah.
need it. Can
Yes,
you
yes.
speak to managing an international team or dealing with international teams? Obviously, companies have goals. Those goals, I may be wrong, but they may be somewhat universally aligned in the sense of, expanding market penetration and growing sales and developing new products and services. But every culture has to be approached differently. Can you speak to that a little bit? You can't just steamroll in. We've already talked about some of the nuances. And another example for people listening, since we know Japan so well, like in the West, we're really used to the teacher taking out their pen and giving us all these like check marks and big red X's and telling us what we need to fix. And I remember when I was at Shinsei Bank, one of my clients came in one day and I was like, "How are you doing?" "Oh, I'm really stressed out." "Why are you stressed out?" "My boss isn't happy." "Why isn't your boss happy?" "I don't know." "Why don't you know?" "He didn't tell me. He's just unhappy." And it was this whole like, they believe in social harmony to the extent that you can't anticipate the other person's need. Another example, I went there for a month visit with some friends, some students on a 30-day trip, and we had gone around Kyoto and I call her my oba-chan, my Japanese grandmother went there. And I remember Matt, he was so hungry, he ate his food so ravenously that the women went and got extra food and brought him an extra serving, but nobody else, because everybody else was eating at a slower pace. And it's just an example where they didn't ask if he wanted more food or needed it. They watched him eating and saw he is going to need more food and went and got, and they got the things that he had eaten more of. Because in Japan, they have you put everything out and then people pick what they want. It's not like Western, like you get your plate and I get my plate. There, it's we all share from all these different plates. And they had then specifically got him what he was eating the most of and got him more of it just for him because they had saw how he was so hungry. And this is an example again, like the staff. So again, back to my question, international or intercultural relations. What are some of the biggest mistakes people are making, and how do you overcome them?
This is the thing, right? I'll go back to the thing that I said earlier about this: to think global, act local. Because, and I think many companies, you want economies of scale, so you're going to create consistency in all these processes. And luckily, in many ways, if you look at the essence in many countries, let me take the example of labor law, right? Labor laws in many countries, they're different. But the essence, the underlying what people want, or why they have created these laws, is the same. It's to protect employees to a certain extent. And the underlying principles on what they do, yeah, the protections in certain countries are more severe if you're an employer, from an employer point of view, than in others. But the underlying stuff, it's all the same. And managing across borders, to your point, I think if you're a multinational company like the one I work in, you want to have a certain consistency across. You need to give a little bit of flexibility. Of course, you can't put people in the rigor, because you need to give people flexibility to make it work in the local context. Right. So you really need to you have this cultural awareness. And quite frankly, if I talk to a leader in China, I would say the same thing. It would be the same message, or even if it's a leader or my direct report, it would be the same message, but the delivery is totally different, because that goes through that cultural filter, if you will. Mm. Right? And even though in some cases I might be much more senior than that person, but I will let the cultural filter dictate what I do. Because if I would be in the US, I could probably say, no, listen, Tom, you're going to do this. I've told you this. This is what we need to do. The same person, same level in, let's say, Thailand, I would treat them differently, because I know culturally it works differently. Thailand is still very hierarchical, men higher than women. Sorry, it's just reality on the ground. Age is there. And then in the end, in this particular case, I might be way more senior than a person in country in Thailand. But from a Thai vantage point, I'm the foreigner, so I'm lower. Like, I could be higher, but technically I'm still lower, right? So you need to think through that lens. So I would be much more obedient — is not the right word, Daryl, but I would be much more, don't you think we should do this? Although I know that we need to do this, just to get people in the right sort of headspace. And it's not easy. And I think this is what a lot of leaders struggle with, because I think at some point when you start leading, you need to forget about your day job, because I think leading becomes the core of your job. And that means this element becomes an intricate part of doing that. And you need to do it day in, day out, every minute of the day, once you start managing across borders, which is actually very taxing, I think. Right. It's draining, right?
It is.
Because it's different. It's a muscle that you don't have. So it's not easy. It's not easy.
100%. So how would you approach employee training and development within the company to continue to improve and grow? Is it a universal approach everywhere? Is it custom for different countries?
But by and large, we create programs with every country in mind. And luckily, and it typically differs a little bit. In our company, we have a central learning and development team that sort of makes a global appropriate training — appropriate is not the right word to use — but that we can send to a global audience. And then in certain cases, what we always do, whatever the training is, whatever the concepts are, they always get a local flavor. The training is designed in, let's say, English as the lingua franca, because you have to do one. And then you start looking, okay, in this country, first of all, I need to translate it into Japanese, Vietnamese, Thai, blah, 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 because most of your population — we're in the logistics industry, so truth be told, probably 75% of your employees in country, their English is just not strong enough. And that's not a quip, but it's just a reality. So you need to already make it — you need to start locally adapting by putting it in the right language. And then you work, actually, as a next filter, work with the local country HRMs, and those are the people that report to me, to say, hey, these are the nuances, but give me your local context where you need to change it. And typically, those are the people that are delivering and facilitating these training, so they can build that in. You bring in the local examples, you bring in the local context, and in certain cases, they get a little bit of freedom to say, this is the message, but you can massage it a little bit to make it more applicable in your country, because otherwise it's in training, what you say, what you do, there's certain colloquialisms that just don't translate. So you need to have that specific lens. I think often companies make the mistake, you have this training, I just push out all the English and I'm done. If you do that, you just reach 10 or 20% of the people, whereas you wanted to reach like 80 or 90. It's a huge miss. And it takes a little bit more time, but the return on investment is gigantic.
Right. So are you saying that it's all done in-house, or it's a combination of in-house and out? Yeah.
Listen, it depends on the company, but I don't know a single company, not even any blue chip company, Fortune 100. Yes, they typically have an in-house team, right? That because you want certain training, you want to own the IP, you'll do it yourself, because you typically have some really good experts that you've hired. But there's always a component on the outside, because certain things, it's just economically, it doesn't really make sense to have that, because otherwise you'd have massive teams. For Toll Group, it's the same. So we have an in-house team of about 10 people. We're actually pretty lean, but we have some designers that do instructional design. We have some coordinators. We have some delivery people that do that. And then we have some tools. So we actually use Skillsoft, or Percipio by Skillsoft, which is, these days you have LinkedIn Learning, Skillsoft. You have a couple of big providers for the mass work, so people can just pick the courses that they want to do.
Right.
And then this team is a little bit more, it creates the curriculum in terms of leadership development, professional development, because you want to train your leaders in your philosophy of your company, which is different for every company, right. Although by and large, it might be the same. So yeah, it's a combo. So you bring that together. But in the end, it depends on how is your learning function funded? How much money do you have? And once you know that, then you create a structure and make it work. And typically it will be something in-house and something outside. And I think the smaller the company becomes, I think the dependency on the outside just increases, because it doesn't really make sense to have in-house people. You just buy some stuff off the shelf.
What specific skills or behaviors do you believe are important for your staff to improve or develop?
Currently, we are very focused, because this day and age, and I think a lot of companies will say something similar, right? It's the VUCA age. We have all these uncertainties, this volatility, this change, and change is a really big one. So I think making people resilient in that sense, things like COVID have taught us that as well. I think that's one. Two is, of course, technology. Where whatever company you are, if you're not looking at technology and where technology is developing, things like AI, how can you harness that for your industry? I think you're going to fall behind. And at some point, you need to make your employees familiar with these concepts so that they can either retool themselves and improve or really fall behind. I think that's another one. And a third one is, generically speaking, and I have to say this, right? I used to be also an OD, organizational design practitioner. I still am, but I had big roles in organizational development. So elements of culture and leadership should not be underestimated, because I think if you do that well, you create a certain energy in your workforce that is very difficult to put a dollar sign on. But in many cases, I think that is what propels companies, because quite frankly, and this is a personal belief, right? It doesn't matter what industry you're in, what company you're in. If you manage it and manage it well, depends on leadership. I think leadership principles and how you show up for your employees, as well as the overall culture, they drive how you can manage a company. And if you do that, I think that's 80% of the equation. Any industry, I would vouch for it.
I think that's fantastic. So yeah, speaking of this, can you speak a little bit more to the future trends? Obviously, there's a lot with technology happening, geopolitically, things are happening. There seems to be unelected people that have their own agenda. They're imposing on the world a little bit. So tensions in certain places are high geopolitically. Culturally, we're going through a lot. And like I said, there's some technological disruptions. So what are the things that you mentioned, AI? But what are some of the things that are on your radar that you think the listeners may need to also make sure they're aware of?
Wow, that's a really good one. I thought you were going to ask me a little bit something more futuristic, Daryl, to be honest. And I was about to say, you know what? I at some point think at some point the whole thing in the geopolitical, or rather the geographical entities like states, they will fall towards the corporates. There's right. movies that have been around. And I still believe if you look at the power that corporates have these days, or power, maybe not the right word, the influence, the spheres of influence, the consumerism. And of course, now you see all this gig working, the borders are disappearing in many ways, and countries and corporates are trying to catch up. But again, that's too futuristic. I don't think that's what you were asking. I think to me, what we're really seeing is this, and we're very early on because we're starting to still figure out what to really do with this. But this whole AI machine learning thing, it's huge. And I think some companies are really struggling to harness it. Right? Things like ChatGPT, and how companies are starting to quickly come up with policies to say, no, as an employee, you can't use it, or you can't use it for this because it's not foolproof and it's open source in certain cases. Yep. So there's all these issues. So I think compliance and governance will remain very important in the years to come. I think that will probably be, let's say, how shall I put this? A little bit of a tool to contain the massive explosion for AI. I think people are starting to catch up on this. So that development and what it, where it will lead will be good. I think in general trends, I'm not sure I'm a really good fortune teller, but I think overall, and I think that is what I would recommend a lot of companies do, because of course, most companies are in the here and now just for the shareholder and produce on a short-term basis. But with this explosion in technology, biotechnology, AI, there's so many opportunities out there. I think for many companies, they need to probably look a little bit beyond the horizon and start to really think, okay, what is the job that I actually need to do? What is the consumer looking for? And the business that I'm in, is this long-term actually going to give my client what it truly needs? Maybe I need to reinvent myself. And I think the companies, you often see this with startups, of course, they jump in on some kind of opportunity and they take off. But for a lot of companies now, with this advent of technology, it's been around for quite some time, but these newer developments, I think a lot of companies really need to stop, pause, and look like, what are some of the other things? Because, and we are here, I'll give you an example. We're in logistics now, in the traditional global logistics, warehousing, and freight forwarding. Is that where we want to be in 3 to 5 years from now? I don't know what the right answer is, right? But where we want to be in this space, it might look very different than what we're doing now. Why not? And I think competitors around you that are doing things vastly different because they are not weighed down by their context and history.
Yeah, the so red I think, tape and even the history. Correct. When you've done something, how long is tolls?
130 years old, basically.
Yeah, so when you've been doing something since 1888, you get set in your ways. Like in some ways, you've got roots that are so deep, your giant tree in the forest. But on the other hand, you also become very entrenched in certain ways, and that may or may not serve you. So that's a great point. That's a very great point. I've got a couple of pages of notes here. This has been a great call. I do want to be respectful of your time. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that I should have asked you about?
Wow. I think this is the best interview question ever. I remember when you do an interview and then you say, have I not asked anything I should have asked you? And you go, like, what? No, I don't think so. Yes, probably. Listen, Daryl, we probably could talk for another 3 hours like that. But any specific questions? No, I don't think so.
So if people want to learn more, if they love your vibe, if they love what you talked about, if they want to engage in any way, shape, or form, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
I'd say LinkedIn. Look me up on LinkedIn. Send me a chat and they just reference like, hey, I saw you with Daryl and want to spend some time or pick your brain for me. And thanks actually for giving me this opportunity, Daryl, because I'd love to pay it forward in that sense, right? I've been in this industry for quite some time. I have some ideas and some people might like them, others might not. That's not the point. But if people want to spar or they're one person in a company and like, how do I solve for that? And especially from an HR perspective, feel free to reach out. I will gladly give you my inputs and advice or meet people over Zoom, whatever, or for a cup of coffee and share my thoughts. Perfect. I'll gladly pay it back.
Yeah. So if people want to check him out, go search on LinkedIn, IWANDELEV. UW.
Yes.
Iwan De Leo. Did I say that right? Leo?
Yeah. It's cool again.
Took a lot of practice, but we got there. Eh? The hamster might be dead, but the wheel is always turning. IwanDeLeuw. Go check him out on LinkedIn. Send him a message. Say hello. Iwan, thank you so much for joining us today. I know you've got thousands of staff, directly people that you're responsible for. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience and I and helping us all learn how to do a little bit better.
Thank you for having me, Dale. This was fun.